and welcome to the UK's number one retro gaming podcast, The Retro Asylum. This is episode 51, and I'm your host, Ali, aka The Retro Hunter. So the theme of today's episode is really all about the history of the home video games console. So I'm going to take you through the machines that made up each generation, right from the very start up until the sixth generation of machine. I won't be going any further than that, otherwise it won't be retro, will it? And as this is a retro gaming podcast, then that just wouldn't be right, would it? So, we're going to start off with a little bit of site news. Well, actually, it's not really about the site as such, it's more some news about one of our co-hosts. Yes, the legendary Glenn Atkinson has recently become engaged to Jackie, his girlfriend. Well, actually, now his fiancé. So on behalf of the rest of the Retro Asylum team, I'd just like to congratulate the both of them on this fantastic piece of news. I actually had the pleasure of meeting Glenn and Jackie at the recent Retromania event, and I've got to say they're both absolutely lovely people, and I'm sure they'll have a very happy life together, hopefully a retro gaming life together. This Sunday, which is the 15th of September, is actually the next scheduled Retro Asylum £20 Essex Car Boot Challenge. This is taking place at the usual car boot sale, which is located in Dunton in Essex. So if you'd like to join us, get in contact with us on Twitter or on the forum, and we can arrange to meet up with you, and you can join our team. If you're unsure about where Dunton is exactly, the boot sale itself has its own website. So just go into Google or another search engine and type in Dunton car boot sale, and I'm sure it will pop up and you'll be able to see all the directions where you need to go. And as I said, contact one of us and we'll arrange to meet up before then as well. So we'll tell you where to go to meet up, because it is a huge boot sale, and the car park is equally as huge, so you will need to kind of swap mobile numbers with us if we do indeed want to meet up, because the chances of bumping into each other are going to be pretty slim because of the size of it. It is a really good laugh as well. If you've not been to a boot sale before, if you've been to loads, if you're an experienced kind of boot sale hunter, it is a real good laugh having a little walk around with a couple of other people, noticing the gems that you can spot and pick up for a bargain price, also noticing the marked up prices, because I've seen Xboxes, the original Xboxes for 40 quid before with no games and stuff. So you pick up the bargains, but you'll also see a few things that you might give you a little bit of a smile. You just want to say to them, you're really not going to sell it at that price, but good luck to them if they end up selling it for that price. Then good luck to them, really. And once we've finished, we always have a sit down as well and grab a tea or a coffee, rest our aching feet, because as I said already, it is a huge boot sale, and I've been before and it's taken me 5 hours just to walk around it and see all the different stalls. So by that time, you really do need to have a little sit down and a cup of tea or a cup of coffee. I normally opt for a bacon roll as well. We'll have a little sit down, talk about our finds, and just really talk about retro gaming in general, really. This month, for the next 4 months, we'll be giving away a prize each month. So this marks the beginning of that prize giveaway. And this month, we're giving away a Sony PlayStation 1, which comes with all the necessary cables, wires, and also 4 games as well. And this was kindly donated by myself, actually. Haha, forgot about that. So stay tuned until the end of the podcast for details on how you can win it. So, sticking to the normal format, what have I been up to? Well, I'm sure you kind of know me by now, so it's always safe to say that I've been doing my usual thing of hunting down those retro gaming bargains. I think I've probably been to 2 or 3 boot sales since the last podcast, and I managed to pick up some really good bits. I won't go into absolutely everything that I've picked up, but the highlights of the last couple of weeks really are probably a Game Boy Pocket with a game I got for £3. I also picked up about 20 Commodore 64 games, some of those games being Gunship, Rygar, and quite a nice little Zap 64 collection with a whole load of different games on there. I think that, yeah, that also actually came with a boxed printer for the Game Boy, which is in really fantastic condition. Actually also comes with some paper already with it, which can be a bit tricky to get hold of if you've got a printer and you kind of want to print things out, but I don't think I'll ever use it. It's one for the collection. It'll probably stay in the box. I might test it one day, but I'm not too sure what exactly I'll be printing off from Game Boy, but still, I'll have a little look into it and see what it's all about. I've got some GameCube games most recently, the Sunday Just Gone for 50p each. No amazing titles on there, no Luigi's Mansion or anything like that, but you know, 50p each, can't really go wrong. Yeah, I think I've got five in total. What else? Sunday Just Gone. I think I've got one of my best pickups for quite a while, actually. I managed to find a boxed Commodore VIC-20, which was actually the first computer my brother ever had, so I had a little bit of exposure to it. So it's all about the nostalgia, isn't it, with that one. To be honest, the box has probably seen better days, but I haven't seen too many of these with the box at all, so you know, it's always a bonus to get a box for something. It was up for £20. It was one of the first things I saw at the boot sale, and I thought, £20 is a good price for it, but I don't want to blow so much money on one of the first stalls that I've seen. You know, you never know what's going to be hiding away somewhere. You know, it might be a Neo Geo AES. I highly doubt it, but you know, you just never know. But I offered him 15 and he accepted it, and I said, you know, do you mind if I open it up to make sure the bits are there? He said, yeah, go ahead, feel free. So I opened it up. You know, the cassette player was there, the manuals were there, a cable was there, but I noticed that the power source wasn't there. I've got a spare Commodore power source at home, but I'm pretty sure that's for an Amiga. So, you know, sometimes you can pick up a machine and you get it cheap, and then you realise it's missing something like the power source, and then you look on eBay or the like, and you know, when you work it out, it doesn't end up being so much of a bargain, because I've seen power sources for about £20 for some consoles and computers before. So once you you pay that amount and you add it all up, it's not always such a great bargain. So just something to be careful of if you're out there hunting, or if you're going to be joining us at the Car Boot Challenge, always make sure the cables are there. The TV cables, you know, the AV cables are normally less of an issue, but definitely ensure the power source is there. So I mentioned this to the seller, and he was saying, you suggest knocking something off. So I said, well, yeah, really, because, you know, I'll have to buy the power source separately. And I was probably thinking £2 or £3. And he handed me a fiver back. And I'm not going to argue for that. So, in fact, in the end, I ended up getting a boxed Commodore VIC-20 for just £10. So you can't turn down a bargain like that, can you? In terms of playing games, it's been a bit of a slow week for me, really, playing the retro games. The only thing I've really had my hands on and had a really good game of is a game I bought off of eBay recently, which is Final Fight 1. So this is the Game Boy Advance version of the original Final Fight game, and I've been playing through it, and it's really, really similar to the arcade mode, I think. I'm a big fan of beat 'em ups, and Final Fight is one of my favourites. Don't worry, Swaney, I do like Double Dragon 2. And Final Fight 1 is a really good version of the game. I mean, I picked up Final Fight for the Mega CD recently, and I've had a good go on that. But the Game Boy Advance version is really, really good. And, you know, because it has that ease of use, you know, the Game Boy Advance is such a small little compact handheld that, you know, you can literally put it in your pocket and kind of forget it's there. So I've been managing to have a good go of this on the train on the way to work. You know, I do get the odd funny look from other commuters thinking, what the hell is he doing, what's he playing there? So that's an ancient handheld, but I really enjoy doing it on the train. It gives me a little bit of time to kind of enjoy a bit of gaming. You know, if I get strange looks now, you wait until I break out my, you know, my Atari Lynx or my Sega Game Gear, because, you know, that is one I expect some strange looks from. Anyway, I'm waffling on as usual, so let's get back to the episode's main topic, which is the history of the home console. I must admit, you know, when I had the initial idea of this podcast, it wasn't really until I started doing my research did I realise just how many early machines there actually were in each of the generations. It really did open my eyes. I have to make clear that I'm not going to cover absolutely every single machine from every single generation, because, you know, this is a podcast. It's not meant to be a kind of 5-hour marathon. So I'm kind of going for the ones that, you know, are going to be more familiar to you, really. Some of them you may have heard of, and there may be the odd one that you might shout at me mid-podcast, how can you not mention that? But if I'm not, it's because maybe I didn't really know too much about it or even knew it existed beforehand. So, as I said, I'm gonna really concentrate on the ones that are the more familiar to the majority of people. So, going to start off at the first generation of the home console, and which did not start with the Atari 2600. In fact, it was a lot earlier than that. It was actually 1972, which actually marked the arrival of the very first video games, you know, the home video game console. And my definition of that is that something that can be attached directly to a TV. And that machine was actually called the Magnavox Odyssey. I don't know if I've got the pronunciation of that right. Never heard anyone say it before, but that's how I'm going to pronounce it. The Odyssey actually lacked a CPU, so in the initial designs of the console, it had a row of switches that, you know, I'm presuming is kind of familiar to what the Atari 2600 ended up having. And this would allow the gamers to turn on and off certain components of the console to create, you know, slightly different games like tennis, volleyball, hockey, you know, those kind of games. However, in the end, Magnavox replaced the Switch design with separate cartridges for each game. The Odyssey itself was only initially mildly successful, really. It wasn't really until the Atari released their arcade game Pong that video games really became popular. Because of the popularity of Pong, Magnavox cancelled the Odyssey and released a scaled down version that only played Pong and hockey, and that was called the Odyssey 100. A second higher end console, which was called the Odyssey 200, was released with the 100 and added on screen scoring for up to 4 players, and a third game called Smash. Almost simultaneously though, Atari released their own home Pong console through Sears, and these consoles really did jumpstart the consumer market. All three of the new consoles used simpler designs than the original Odyssey, with no onboard game pieces or extra cartridges. In the years that followed, the market really saw a multitude of companies rushing similar consoles to the market, and this really happened because a company called General Instrument released inexpensive microchips, each containing a complete console on a single chip, really. So, you know, many small developers began releasing consoles that looked, you know, different externally, but really internally they were playing, you know, exactly the same games. There was a massive explosion in Pong machines. You know, I've got quite a few myself in my own collection. There really was probably in the hundreds of these machines around, and you know, you see them popping up at car boot sales or in charity shops or secondhand shops quite regularly, to be honest. You know, the consoles from the first generation were mostly dedicated consoles playing only the games that came with the console. These video games consoles were often just called video games because there was little reason to distinguish the two as yet. While a few companies like Atari and Magnavox and a newcomer called Coleco really pushed the envelope, the market, you know, became flooded with simple similar video games, really. Now, something I'm going to do after, the next generation, which is the second, is I'm going to play an advert for you of what my favourite machine was from that generation. Unfortunately, I couldn't really find any for the Magnavox Odyssey. So it will kick in after this next generation, which of course was the second generation of consoles. And this began in 1976 with the release of a machine called the Fairchild Channel F, and also another machine by Radiofin Electrics, which was the 1292 Advanced Programmable Video System. The early period of this generation, saw the release of several consoles as different companies decided to enter the market. Later, the releases were in direct response to earlier consoles. Of course, the dominant console for this generation was the legendary Atari 2600. There were other consoles also enjoying decent market share as well. There was consoles such as the Intellivision, there was the Odyssey 2, and there was the ColecoVision. But, the clear winner in this really was the Atari 2600, and the second generation is what got me into consoles, to be honest with you. I still remember the Christmas day when we got the Atari 2600 between my brother and I, and my addiction to video games kind of really began. There's hundreds of games out for it as well, and I've even started playing it recently now, a bit of combat with my son, and it's still really playable. The Atari 2600 really will have a place in my heart for the rest of my life, and I'm gonna guess that there's a few of you out there probably thinking exactly the same thing. The second generation really did come to an abrupt end in 1984, which of course was the infamous video game crash, which actually started the year before, to be honest. But yeah, it wasn't a good time for the video games market at all. There was a few other machines really that made up the second generation of console as well, so I'll just give you a list of the machines themselves. As I've already mentioned, there was the Fairchild Channel F, the Atari 2600, the Intellivision. Later was the Atari 5200, of course the Vectrex, a very favourite of our co-host Swainy there. There was an Emerson Arcadia 2001, the ColecoVision, as previously mentioned, and a machine called the Bally Astrocade.
You're a starship captain in an asteroid field. Blast them with your lasers or put up your shields. As a missile commander defending your city, if you're not quick enough, they'll show no pity. The invaders won't stop us from the sky they drop.
Three out of this world games from Atari, the number one video computer system with more games than any other.
Everyone's gone Atari, the number one video game.
So, moving on really to the third generation of the video games console now. And this really is the start really of what is known as the 8-bit era on the video games side. And it marks the entrance into the market really of the two real big boys, and that being obviously Nintendo and Sega. So, really, if you want to track back the beginning of the third generation, it'll probably have to be July the 15th, 1983, which was the Japanese release of both the Nintendo Family Computer, which was later known as the Nintendo Entertainment System, or the NES in the rest of the world, and the Sega SG-1000. This generation marked the end of which really was the North American kind of video game crash of 1983, and a real shift in dominance of the home video games from the United States really to Japan, and the transition from block-based graphics to tile and sprite-based graphics as well. And then that was a pretty pivotal leap in video game design for the time. the best-selling console of this generation was the NES, or as it was known in Japan, the Famicom. And actually, that remained the best-selling home computer console right up until the release of the fifth generation PlayStation, followed really by the Sega Master System, which really dominated the European and South American markets. But the Sega Master System really didn't make a big impact in North America whatsoever. That was solely kind of Nintendo's territory, so to speak. I mean, I'm sure there was a very small percentage of gamers that were playing on a Sega Master System, but it was heavily kind of tipped towards the Nintendo NES. Although the previous generation of consoles had also used 8-bit kind of processors, it was at the end of this generation that the home consoles, you know, were first labelled by their bits. This really came into fashion as, you know, the 16-bit systems like the Mega Drive were marketed to really differentiate between the generations of consoles. I mean, you can imagine lots of kind of, you know, parents in America, in the UK, being pestered by their kids saying, you know, I want this new console, you know, and their, you know, the parents kind of saying, well, you've got this one, what's the difference? But I guess it's quite a clever marketing ploy to show the real difference between them. I mean, not that parents probably understood the difference between 8-bit and 16-bit, but generally if you buy a product and the number has doubled, is a bit of psychology to show you that it's actually a better product. The end really of the third generation of video games comes as 8-bit consoles really became obsolete in graphics and processing power really compared to the 16-bit consoles. But, you know, if you look back to the third generation, that is where some of the, you know, the most popular game series ever launched their first versions. And this is mainly really on the Nintendo, but, you know, games like Super Mario Brothers and Zelda and Mega Man, you know, that was where you got the first versions of those games, and you know they're still around today. You know, Mario, you know, Super Mario is a complete juggernaut and a releasing multiple volumes of games every year. Zelda, you know, less so, but that still has its kind of, you know, release at least kind of once every couple of years. And even Mega Man is still releasing games now, I think maybe just on the kind of DS or the 3DS, but certainly still around today and still have lots and lots of fans. You know, some of the Zelda games on the different consoles are some of the most highest priced games to buy secondhand if they're in good condition, etc., because the fan base just really is so big for them. Mario, of course, what can you say about Mario, really? One of the most famous gaming icons out there, really, and still, yeah, generating game after game after game after game, really, and will probably go on like that for years to come as well. But quite an important thing that they came out such a long time ago. Now, really, the third generation really is still giving in that kind of respect.
Sega challenges you with the ultimate video game, the Sega Master System.
Hang on.
With more accurate control, more detailed graphics, more levels of play.
Awesome!
The Sega Master System comes with power base, 2 control pads, light phaser, and 2 great video games, Hang On and Safari Hunt.
Gotcha!
And with other games like Rambo, Outrun, and Choplifter, the excitement never stops. The Sega Master System. The challenge will always be there.
So, moving on now to the fourth generation of the video games consoles, which is probably what caught a lot of people my age is attention. You know, I mean, I'm 35 now, so when this generation was at its highest, I was at that age where it's probably, you know, 12 or so, something like that, and I really, really got into the video games. You know, you'd started speaking to your friends at school about what system they had. You know, did they have a Nintendo? Did they have a Sega? And, you know, the playground battles began as to, you know, who had the best system, etc. And that was a war that was obviously fought between the companies as well. But if you go back to the first system that was released in what is known as the fourth generation, it might surprise you to know that it was actually the Japanese release of NEC's PC Engine, which is better known to Europe and, you know, North America as the TurboGrafx-16. Although NEC released the first fourth generation console, this era was completely and utterly dominated by the rivalry between, you know, the companies Nintendo and Sega. You know, the Super Nintendo system itself, you know, known as the Super Famicom in Japan, and the Mega Drive, and, you know, known as the Genesis in North America, were the systems that really divided the playground itself. And, you know, it was Nintendo in the end that was able to capitalize really on their previous success in the third generation, and they went on to win the largest worldwide share, you know, market share in the fourth generation as well. The Mega Drive was out first, and I'm guessing that a few people probably did what I did. I mean, I love the Mega Drive. I have, you know, many different versions of it now, and I still play it regularly. It's a great machine for that arcade feel. I think really did bring you as close as you could get really to the arcades back then. But when the Super Nintendo was launched, I remember seeing the adverts for it and just thinking, wow, this looks absolutely amazing. And of course, at that time, Sega didn't have, you know, their main icon, which I'll go on to later. So when the Super Nintendo was bundled with a copy of Super Mario World, which I still think today is one of the best games ever made, personally, that really got their console sold. Having that game with it was a really good, you know, marketing tool to use. I mean, I think if I remember correctly, the game that was originally you know, bundled with the Sega Mega Drive was, I think, Altered Beast, I think. And, you know, later down the line, you know, Sega looked at what Mario was for the Nintendo in terms of, you know, sales and being an absolutely, you know, iconic kind of mascot for the company, that, you know, that there was a group formed within Sega, you know, the company Sega, saying, you know, you guys are going to put your heads together and you're going to work out and come up with an absolutely, you know, an icon for our company. And, you know, the rest is history, really. That was where Sonic the Hedgehog was born. I think the team that made him up were actually known as Team Sonic as well. So, although Sega were extremely successful in that generation, it was Sonic's inclusion which really tried to help them fight back some market share on Nintendo's Mario series of games. The fourth generation, for me, looking back on it, is probably my favourite. It's definitely where I have the most fondest memories of playing my Mega Drive, and to me, the Super Nintendo is definitely my favourite. Just looking back on some of the games that I played, they just, you know, gives me the majority of the nostalgia rushes that I need now to kind of get on with it. There were another specific console that was released in the fourth generation, but really, in comparison, it was anything but a fourth generation console. You know, this, if you lined up the Sega Mega Drive and the Nintendo Super, you know, the Super Nintendo, and then you lined up this next to it, there was absolutely no comparison or argument as to what was the better console. And of course, I'm talking about the Neo Geo AES system that was released by SNK. Now, this was not really widely successful, and the obvious reason for that was because it cost a hell of a lot of money. A lot of money. I believe it was around £600 to buy the system itself, and then each game, which if you've never seen or held a Neo Geo AES game cartridge, you could probably fit, I think, probably four or five of, you know, Mega Drive cartridges, or possibly more, you know, Super Nintendo cartridges on it just because of the size of it. I mean, they are absolutely huge, and I'd always heard about these consoles, you know, in the back of the computer magazine, you'd have these, you know, lists of consoles and games from companies that you could send away to buy, and I would always see the Neo Geo listed there and notice how much difference in price it was between the other ones, but I'd never actually physically played on one ever, or even ever seen one in the flesh. And I was lucky enough to win a bid on eBay and bought one a couple of months back. So, you know, I was waiting in eagerly for it to be delivered, and when it was, I, you know, unboxed it as quickly as possible, set it all up and started to play the games. And I knew for the money it would have to be in a different league to the other machines in the fourth generation, but I never realized just how much. And wow, the amount of colors that it can, you know, show on the screen at the same time, and the playability of the game. It, you know, it came bundled with one of the Neo Geo arcade sticks, which has one of those, you know, really really good quality clicking kind of directional sticks that gives you really good control over, you know, what you have on screen. I can't imagine having one of those back in the day, you know, the mid 90s, when everyone else was playing on a Super Nintendo or a Sega Mega Drive, to think that, you know, some lucky rich kid somewhere was playing on a Neo Geo would have really probably made me as green as you could possibly be with envy, wanting to have one myself. But I've read something interesting about the Neo Geo AES as well, and that was the fact that actually it was never ever intended to be a home video console. What it was actually originally manufactured for was for you know, very high class hotels, etc. So they were manufactured specifically for hotels, so that, you know, very well off people really would rent them out while they were staying in the hotel itself, and that's where they originated from. And, you know, seeing the success of those, they obviously thought, you know, we can make a bit of money here, so they decided to release them to the public. But as I said, the extremely high price tag on that really really did limit their real success in the market. But, you know, this is the generation which really did also make some other companies start to take notice of the maturing video games industry, and they also began making some plans of their own, really, to bring out a system in the future. Another machine really that was also released in this generation was the Philips CDI, but again that was quite a high retail price, and that didn't really kick off particularly either. That wasn't really a particularly popular machine. And of course there was quite a few add-ons for some of the machines launched in this generation as well, which, you know, arguably pushed the capabilities of the machine really into the next generation. You know, most notably these were the Mega CD for the Sega Mega Drive and the 32X for the Sega Mega Drive as well. So, you know, I'm really classing these in the fourth generation purely because Sega themselves brought out a completely different machine in the fifth generation. So while arguably they're more advanced than the fourth generation, I'm really leaving them here because that's when they did come out. There was also a Turbo CD add-on for the Turbo Graphics, but again that was a very rare site that you ever saw one of those. I certainly didn't know anybody that had one, and I don't believe I've even ever seen one since then. Now, Nintendo, this is a bit of a famous story here, so I'm sure you've all heard this, but if not, it may surprise you as it did me the first time I heard this. But there's quite a famous story where Nintendo, you know, were clearly looking at what Sega were doing with the Mega CD and the 32X, and they thought, you know, everyone seems to be shifting to CDs now. Maybe we need to be working on creating a, you know, a CD-ROM extension for the Super Nintendo. So what Nintendo actually did was they actually started working with Sony, and they started plans really to create a, you know, a separate CD-ROM drive for the Super Nintendo. And, you know, that resulted in something, you know, prototype called the PlayStation. And probably to their great regret to this day, Nintendo actually eventually decided not to go with the project. As you'll guess, Sony obviously decided to go ahead with the CD-ROM development and kept the name PlayStation, and they made their own standalone, you know, CD-based console, and we all know how that ended up.
Nothing prepares you for the amazing new Super Nintendo Entertainment System. You won't believe the power. You won't believe the control. You won't believe the jumps, the curves, or the feeling you get until you experience it for yourself.
Whoa! That's fast!
F-Zero for the ultimate G-Force, only in the next generation from Nintendo. Now you're playing with superpower.
So, moving on now to the fifth generation of console. This really was known as the, you know, 32-bit era, or some would say the 64-bit era, or even some may go further and call it the 3D era. This really kicked off in around 1993, and, you know, more or less lasted until the year 2001. And this was then dominated by three consoles. So you have Nintendo, you have Sega, and now you have Sony entering the marketplace, and you can probably hear Nintendo kicking themselves now. The demographics, you know, in console sales really varied widely, but these three consoles, and especially the PlayStation, defined, you know, the console wars of that era. There was also the 3DO, the Atari Jaguar, the Amiga CD32, and a rare thing called a PCFX, which was actually done by NEC, the, you know, the manufacturers of the PC engine. So there were several others as well taking part in this era, but their sales were very poor, and they really struggled to make a significant impact on the market. By this time, you know, bit ratings for consoles had largely, you know, fallen by the wayside, to be honest. The only real notable exceptions to this was the Nintendo 64, which had quite heavy usage of references to the 64-bit processing power, and also really the Atari Jaguar. They both really, you know, used the 64-bit as the advertising ploy to those, but, you know, the number of bits cited in consoles' names really referred to the CPU word size, and had been used really by hardware marketers to show, you know, the power of the console for many years. So, to be honest, there's little really to be gained from increasing word size much beyond 32 or 64 bits, because once this level is reached, performance really depended more on varied factors, you know, such as the processor clock speed, bandwidth, and really memory size. The 32, or, you know, 64-bit era, whatever you want to call it, is probably most noted really for the rise of fully 3D games. While there were some games prior, you know, to this that used three-dimensional environments, you know, games such as Virtua Racing or even Star Fox on the SNES, it was really in this era that many game designers began to move traditionally 2D, you know, to 3D genres. You know, early efforts from the then industry leaders Nintendo and Sega saw the introduction of the, you know, the Super FX chip, and the Sega 32X, which provided kind of rudimentary 3D capabilities to what was the 16-bit, you know, SES and the Sega Mega Drive, and Super Mario 64 on the N64, and Crash Bandicoot on the PlayStation, and you had Tomb Raider on the Saturn. You know, they're all real prime examples of this trend. Their 3D environments were widely marketed, and they steered the industry's focus away from, you know, a personal favourite of mine, which is side-scrolling, which kind of for me defines the retro game itself. You know, as well, it did open more doors to more complex games and genres, of course. 3D became the main focus in this era, as well as the slow and extremely sad decline of cartridges in favour of CDs. You know, this was really due to the ability to produce games less expensively, which of course meant cheaper prices for consumers for those games themselves. It also allowed, you know, the game's developers to include, you know, dramatic cutscenes and, you know, symphonic kind of music, and the term interactive movie became less associated with games that made heavy use of, you know, full motion video, and more with games with an action movie kind of feel to them, such as, you know, the classic Metal Gear Solid. Some other consoles that deserve to be mentioned here in this era are the 3DO, the FM Towns Marty, the extremely rare and expensive Pioneer Laser Active, the Amiga CD32, there was the Neo Geo CD, which was SNK's attempt really at making a Neo Geo console cheaper and more accessible to the mass market. Unfortunately, with that, it was an extremely slow CD drive that they fitted to it, and I've heard of, you know, some games taking 5 to 10 minutes to load, which really is a backward step back to the, you know, the loading of a tape on the old kind of computer side. There was also the PC FX, and there also was a machine called the Apple Bandai Pippin. If any of you have got one of those or have seen one of those, let me know, because I've never ever seen one in my life.
Hello, citizens of Europe. As spokesperson for SAPS, the Society Against PlayStation, I'd like to talk to you about a menace threatening humanity. It's happening right here, in our very homes, and corrupting the lives of our loved ones. Yes, friends, I'm talking about this. It may look like a harmless bagel toaster, but inside is a deadly donut. How do you know PlayStation is not a normal game system? It carries these telltale signs. Scientists say its effects are mind-boggling. Users lose all sense of reality and enter another world. Here we have a normal, healthy young man. And here we have a fellow who's been experimenting with PlayStation for only a few minutes. Proof that we saps must be on our guard. Remember, do not underestimate the power of PlayStation.
Now on to the sixth generation, which is really the last generation that I'm going to focus on. It's not particularly old, but these things now are becoming known as kind of retro as time's moving on. Now, the sixth generation really refers to the home consoles that were available at the turn of the 21st century, which you know, if you look at it kind of lasted from 1998. More or less up to the year 2009. Platforms of the sixth generation include the Sega Dreamcast, the Sony PlayStation 2, the Nintendo GameCube, and the Microsoft Xbox, and I think for the first time everyone was using a CD-based game. Cartridges had gone, unfortunately. My view, I always prefer cartridges. You know, you can get a game to work by blowing on it on a CD. If it's scratched, it's kind of more or less done for. For me, I'm much more of a cartridge fan. So this era really began on the 27th of November 1998 with the Japanese release of the Sega Dreamcast. It was joined by the PlayStation 2 in March 2000, and the GameCube and the Xbox followed a bit later in 2001. The Dreamcast itself was sadly discontinued in 2001, the GameCube was discontinued in 2007, and the Xbox stopped production in 2008. It was only the PlayStation 2 which really kept on living, and to be honest, was actually still being produced after the sixth generation ended and was only discontinued in the beginning part of this year, 2003. So that really tells you absolutely everything of what system ruled the sixth generation completely and utterly, really. And as I said, I'm not really going to dwell too much on the sixth generation as it's still pretty recent. However, I do really want to give a special mention to Sega's Dreamcast, because this was the first console of the generation, and it introduced some absolutely amazing innovations to gaming, which was so far ahead of kind of anything else, and I think probably so far ahead that people just didn't understand it and didn't get it. And unfortunately, that meant that the sales didn't do particularly well. The problem was as well that, you know, on the previous generation, of course, was the Sega Saturn, but yeah, the Saturn didn't do commercially particularly well, and you know, you can trace that back really to, I think, some errors that Sega did in terms of releasing the Mega CD and then releasing a 32X, and then, you know, they completely stopped supporting it at all.
It was a sad end, really. It was very sad to see Sega go from the console market, but mistakes happened, and you know, Nintendo won, so that was the end of that, really. But I hope you've enjoyed my little look at the different generations of the video games console.
Play games? Why don't we play together? Dreamcast, up to 6 billion players.
I'd just like to thank our sponsors this month. You guys sponsoring us on a monthly basis, you know, we wouldn't be able to do the podcast. The hosting fees are a considerable amount, and you know, none of us make any money for this show, so we rely on contributions from our members. So thank you very much this month to Tony Day, Michael Keith, Anthony Ogden, and Mr. Sid. Thank you very much, guys. If any of you listeners would like to donate to help keep us going, then if you pop onto the forum or the website, firstly, there's a little donate page on the bottom left hand corner. Follow that and then it will make a payment directly from your PayPal account, so that's how you do it if you'd like to do it. Anyway, on with some information about the competition. If you would like to win a PlayStation 1, and as I said earlier in the podcast, we're giving away a prize every month for the next 4 months. September's prize is a PlayStation 1. All you need to do is leave us an iTunes review. If you've already left us an iTunes review, then you are already automatically entered into the competition. Which does kind of lead us nicely onto the next part, which is iTunes reviews. I think we're up to 95 iTunes reviews now. Let's have a look. We've had a five-star review from Phil Cave. He says, if you're an old goat like me, who started out in IT in the early 80s, then you will love this. I listen to the podcast on my walk to the office and always enjoy the memories it brings back. It's just a shame that when I get to the office, I have to fire up a Windows PC and Visual Studio. Thanks a lot for that, Phil. Hope you to continue enjoying listening to the podcast. And the 95th review we have is from Ty Blobs. Says, so that's got to be a good thing. The hosts say that they don't do any research, so it's just chatting away about retro games like two blokes in a pub, and that's fine. However, listened to episode 31 today and it sounded like two blokes who knew exactly what they were talking about. Really enjoyed it. just listened to the behind-the-scenes show, which was very entertaining. I removed my comment about Andy's accent, as it wasn't a criticism. I just curious and wondered if, like me, he had a telephone voice that he uses for the podcast. Turns out his accent is a product of an astonishing mix of influences. I really enjoy the show. Thank you very much, Ty Blobs. Leads us on to Andy as well, really. Andy is currently taking a month off, so a big shout out to Andy. Hope you're enjoying your time away. Hope you've got time to actually play some games, etc. And look forward to, you know, hearing a podcast from you when you return. And to everyone else, thank you for listening, guys. Hope you've enjoyed the show. And I'm going to leave you with a little piece of music. It's going to be the theme from that's a race. It's a theme from F-Zero on the Super Nintendo. Very good track. Thank you very much, guys. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.